I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hey, it's Helen Hong, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. Oh, for fuck's sake, Josh. God. Get your shit together, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio. What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, my guest is Helen Hong. Very funny comedian, actress, podcaster, all of that. She's got a new special, Well Hung, that you definitely want to check out. And we get into it. We have a great conversation. We talk about influence and inspiration. We talk about she taught me some shit I didn't know about the difference in the comedy scene between LA and New York and what it means to start over in that business. She's got some great stories about, you know, just keeping it real on stage. Talking about things that are uncomfortable or, you know, what she calls the elephant in the room. She's got a great story about bringing her dad into her comedy and, you know, what that's been like working with him. Great stuff. Let's get into it right now with Helen Hong.
But yeah, thanks for making time to do this.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I just watched the special, the screener, Well Hung. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Super fun. And
I named it Well Hung because I'm a 12-year-old boy.
Sure.
I have the maturity of a 12-year-old boy.
I mean, why not? And I think collectively we all have the maturity of a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, I mean, that's why. Yeah, exactly. That's why I sell tickets because.
Sure. Exactly. And then I think especially breaking through on social media, right? Like, you need. It's funny how naming things has changed so much because, you know, now something's got to stand out. You know, in a hashtag or on a social network in a different way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I feel like as a stand-up comedian, naming a comedy album is always like,
is that right?
So, yeah. That's why you get so many, you know, comedy albums that are called like Live at the Comedy Store.
Sure.
or like, you know, Thursday Night. Or like, what, you know, like everyone's like, what, I gotta name this thing now? I don't know.
Sure. I always wonder how like jazz or electronic music that has no lyrics, like how they come up with titles.
And they always have poetic. They're just like the essence of life, the album. And you're like, oh, okay,
exactly.
I'll listen to the essence of life. Or
why not?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, but comics, we're not poetic at all, which is why it's
poetry in a way. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I got a lot of questions for you.
Yeah.
But I was just listening to your podcast, Go Fact Yourself.
Uh-huh.
Which is super fun. I was listening to the Jazzy Jeff episode.
Isn't that cool?
He's my favorite DJ, and I've done some work with him over the years.
Yeah.
Really enjoying that.
I really like him. He's just got a really nice outlook on life and vibe, and just really thankful and humble. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally awesome guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and you see why, you know, someone can build a career that's I think now four decades. You know.
Yeah, and he's never slapped anybody on stage.
Not yet.
As far as we know, maybe he has.
Exactly. Well, the year's not over, so we'll see what happens. So I have a question about your musical background. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
The first record I ever bought for myself? I want to say it was something... I think it was Madonna.
Okay.
That
would be fair.
Yeah, I think it was Madonna.
Which one?
No, it wasn't Madonna. You know what it was? It was Depeche Mode.
One of my favorites.
Violator.
Oh, great record.
Right?
Yeah. That's a good place to start. That's a good place to start.
Yeah, and they're also the first concert I ever saw.
Is that right?
The Violator tour. Yeah, I was really young. Yeah, I like got permission from my parents, and they drove me. My dad drove me out to the, and I had an older friend. So I skipped a grade because I was a genius in fourth grade.
Of course.
So I skipped a grade. So I was like a year younger than everybody in my grade, and then I had a friend who. I think she wasn't held back because she like academically, but there was something about like moving or something like, anyway, she was a year older. So she was 2 years older than me, even though we were in the same grade.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so she had cigarettes. And so I'm like
smoking cigarettes at the Depeche Mode.
12 or something. And I'm smoking cigarettes. And it was like, so exciting. It was so exciting.
That's funny. I went and saw Depeche Mode. I'm older than you. And so we went to the Music for the Masses tour.
Oh.
Which so that would have been 87, 88.
They did a documentary like about that tour.
Yeah. And yeah, that was.
Yeah, I remember watching it being like, oh my God, if only I had been there. Like, so exciting.
It was really cool. But what I, you know, my friends and I were all, my friends and I were like, wherever the party is, that's where we are. And if it's hip hop, we're into hip hop. If it's, you know, Depeche Mode, we're into Depeche Mode, right? If there's girls and alcohol, then we're there.
Yeah.
And so we got to the Depeche Mode concert, and like everybody there is dressed in black, except us. We're all like preppy, whatever. You know, I grew up in San Francisco, but we all look like East Coast prep school kids. And polos and all that, and we show up at this Depeche Mode concert
with
all
these Vespa.
But yeah, and we had no idea that that whole subculture even existed.
Oh, you know what's so fascinating that I've learned since moving to California is there's a weird, like Depeche Mode is weirdly super popular with like Mexican Americans.
Yes,
like a Latin American goth underground. Well, and they're super
definitely. Into
Depeche Mode and like the Smiths.
It's Morrissey. Like this is like Morrissey Central.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't understand oddly enough, like that kind of music was really popular with Korean Americans in
New right?
York. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's how I got into it, is like Korean American friends were really into like Depeche Mode and New Order. And like that kind of music.
Yeah.
New wave, I guess it was called.
Yeah, totally. No, yeah. You're right. It's interesting, you know, the differences around the country. And, you know, LA just happens to have a massive Latino population. Yeah. And so there's like Latin ravers and Latin metalheads and Latin everything, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember when I moved here, the same thing. Like, all these Morrissey fans.
Yeah.
With the, like, with the pompadours and.
Just moody looking and the whole thing. It was so interesting to me, like, this whole, like, Latin American goth culture. Yeah. I guess it's not goth. It's just, like, I don't know. I don't even know what it's called.
Yeah, it was kind of like 80s goth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really funny. So, and then how did you get into comedy? Were you a fan first?
No, not at all. I actually am kind of, I'm kind of distinctive in that way. So, you know, my parents are first generation immigrants and they like don't speak English well. So like I didn't grow up with American culture in the house. Like my parents didn't speak English well enough to be into like TV shows or music or stand-up comedy, especially like your language skill has to be pretty good to understand stand-up. So I never grew up with stand-up in the house. I didn't know stand-up albums were a thing. I didn't know stand-up was a thing. Like, they didn't watch The Tonight Show. I didn't watch comics on TV. Like, none of that. Like, I had zero interaction with stand-up comedy until, like, I think Margaret Cho, like, when I was in college, you know what I mean?
I went to high school at Margaret.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah, and she's, like, a couple years older than me, but...
Got it. So weren't friends?
We were at the same time. No, we were like the same sort of broader group, but we didn't like hang out.
Was she doing stand up then? Do you know?
She was acting. I went to a school of the arts. So she was acting at the time. I don't know. I think I've seen her talk about going like downtown to the CD clubs and doing stand up while she was in high school.
Yeah.
I mean, she was groundbreaking.
Absolute legend. And the fact that she was doing stand-up at, like, she talks about how she started at 15 years old.
Yeah.
And she was chubby, like a chubby Asian woman in the 80s doing stand-up comedy. Like, that was unheard of. And she is definitely one of the people who paved the way for me. So it wasn't like, even when I was doing, you know, when I started stand-up, I was still really unusual. And that was part of, like, my charm, I guess. People would be like, oh, that. Asian, you know, the little Asian girl's like opens her mouth and says like disgusting things. But you know, at least I had a template. Like Margaret was the template where Margaret had nobody to look up to.
Sure.
So she was really like a badass to me. But so I think I discovered Margaret like in college because I was like, you know, with Asian American feminist, you know, kind of, you know, when you're in college and everything is idealistic and you're like, I'm going to spell woman with a Y.
Okay.
You know, and it's like, oh God, you know, I was such an idiot.
You're supposed to do stuff like that when you're young.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what was the first time on stage?
I actually took a class.
Okay.
That's how I got into stand up. Yeah. Okay. I took a class. Like well into my 20s, I was working a job that I hated and it was,
what was that?
Like I was a TV producer.
Okay.
Or, not reality, but like women's lifestyle programming. So shows like What Not to Wear and to the Dress, like a lot of TLC kind of stuff, you know, like,
so very feminist.
Exactly. Yeah. I caved. My feminism caved to like making money.
Hey, you gotta eat.
So that's what I was doing. And I just didn't know I knew I wanted to be a performer and I knew I wanted to be in the entertainment industry, but I just had no template for that. And I had no encouragement from my family. Like I didn't think that being an actor or a comedian or a performer was a possibility for me. Like I'm a Korean American woman.
Right.
And, so I thought, you know, I went to school for broadcast journalism being like, I'll be like Connie Chung. Like she's about as close as I could get to being on TV, an Asian person on TV.
I mean, she's another icon, like groundbreaking. Probably the first Asian woman a lot of people ever saw on TV.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And huge, like just, you know, the nightly news. Yeah. Then I found out she was married to Maury Povich, and I was like, fuck that. I'm not emulating this bitch with poor choices. she's Mrs. Are You the Father?
Oh, man.
Did you know that? She's married
to Maury Povich. He didn't have the show, I think. I think their marriage might have predated. I think he became that Maury Povich later.
Yeah,
he followed in her footsteps instead of...
So,
that's so funny.
So I was a TV producer in my 20s. I didn't like it. I was super miserable. I was working a job that I, at the time, that I hated. It was like the worst TV job I ever worked. And I was just depressed and I was looking for a way to cheer myself up. This was in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I got invited, a friend of a friend took a comedy class at Caroline's, which is, you know, one of the biggest clubs in New York City. It's like right in Times Square.
Sure.
And he was like, oh, I took this stand-up comedy class and we're doing a graduation show and we have to invite all our friends and family. And I was like, I didn't know stand-up comedy, like I didn't know that was a class you could take.
Right.
That's interesting. So I went and he was terrible. I've never heard from him again. So I'm assuming he no longer does stand up and that's good riddance because he was terrible. But it was an interest, you know, like on the table, they had all these flyers that was like, hey, do you want to try taking this class too? And I was like, yeah, I'm like super bummed out right now with my job. Like I need something to cheer me up.
Sure.
So I signed up for this class. You know, and you can't teach stand-up comedy. Like, it's not a thing you can teach. Basically, what it is you're just in a room with 8 other people or, you know, 9 other people that also want to try stand-up comedy.
And
you're
practice.
Bouncing jokes. It's just having, like, a sympathetic audience of 8 to 10 people that also want to try it, too. And so you're trying out your jokes, and they're like, oh, that's funny, but maybe you could try this different punchline, or maybe you could approach it this way. So it was like, you know, an 8-week class or something. And then we also had a graduation show at Caroline's. Mm-hmm. And we all invited our friends and family and it ended up being like sold out, like 250 people
at
Caroline's on Broadway. Of course it was like 3 PM on a Sunday.
Prime time.
Exactly. That's when the graduation shows happen. But it ended up being packed and I was so nervous. I thought I was going to puke. I couldn't eat all day. And I'm like pacing in the green room. I swear to God, there's like a burn in the carpet from the time that I was there, like doing stand up for the first time. And I was so nervous and I was sweating and I got on stage and I thought I was going to barf. But then I did it and I got my first laugh. And the second I got that first laugh, that was it. I was hooked.
Really?
It was like it was like heroin and cocaine and like meth, I'm assuming, I'm told. At the same time, it was like the heavens opened and God smiled on me. I could hear the angels singing. Yeah, it was crystal clear.
Wow.
I was so hooked and this is all I ever wanted to do ever again. And that was like 16 years ago and I never stopped.
Wow.
Never stopped after that. I just started doing like bringer shows and open mics and as much as however I could get on stage. And yeah, that's my origin story.
That's amazing. I mean, that's amazing to have that clarity.
Yeah.
Instantly, right?
Instantly. It was like, I was so nervous, but the second I got that first laugh, that was it. That was like my future path was like, crystal clear. I was like, this is all I want to do ever for the rest of my life.
So how long did that last? Like, I've talked to a few comics who similar, like they knew or they felt it in the first moment. And then usually not too long after that, they bombed.
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Actually, I was really lucky. I didn't bomb probably for the first year.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, but it was because I was doing bringer shows.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Bringer shows is like, it's your friends and family. They're like a sympathetic audience. And then, you know, I was cute and young and Asian and like saying disgusting things. And people find that really charming. So I had a really lucky run of like the whole first year I didn't bomb. That second year though,
Right?
Oh yeah, like this was in New York City. It's like some of the roughest audiences in the world.
Yeah.
Like they will let you know if you're not funny. And I remember doing like there was a like an urban night, which I hate saying that, but like you know what I mean? It's like it's black and brown night or whatever.
Right.
And this was definitely my second year in and I just, my cutesy little like Asian persona that I was rocking at the time, like they were like not having it. They were like, get the fuck out of here. Like, who the fuck are you? And so I ate it so hard. And I ate it in the worst way possible, which is like, I remember like the room wasn't packed and there was one table that was one group, like a party of 17 people.
Oh man.
And they were all like Dominican. And they were not having me. They did not think I was cute at all. And they just started talking amongst themselves.
Oh.
And like laughing and joking, like just having a party in the middle of my set, and I'm on stage, and I'm supposed to be on stage for 8 minutes, and I remember getting the light at 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I saw that light, and I was like, thank God. And I just,
I mean, you're probably,
I'm
sure
thankful to see that light, and I just jumped because I was eating it so hard.
And then so then you go right back out, like,
absolutely. I got off stage. I was feeling so miserable. Do you know a comedian named Yamanika?
No.
She's based out of New York, Yamanika Saunders. She's amazing. She is an awesome comic. And she had been doing it maybe a few years more than me. And she was a regular at that club. She's a Black woman from, I think she's from Harlem. Mm-hmm. She is my hero because I came off stage and she pulled me aside right away, was like, fuck them, it's not you. Everybody has a bad night. Don't you worry, fuck them. You're funny, you're talented. Just, you got to get back out there and fuck them.
Wow.
And I will never forget, like, that was like the best.
Yeah, that's,
you know, it was like the best thing I could have heard. And the fact that she just, you know, I didn't know her that well. Like, we weren't friends. And the fact that she took the time to, like, just give me those words of, you know, those like kind words and to give me that boost of confidence. And it was like so great. And so to this day, like, she's one of my favorite people. And she's like what I consider one of the good ones, you know?
Yeah.
She just didn't have to take me under her wing that like that, but I'll never forget that she did that. And I was right back at that club the very next night.
Is that right? Same club.
The very next night, same club. Because I remember they did these night. It was like urban night, and it was a producer that did a Friday and a Saturday. So I bombed on a Friday, and I was right back on stage on the Saturday.
Oh, wow.
At that same room, same club, same producer. Nice. And I did better.
Does that come up now? Like, do you, when you're faced with adversity or failure or, you know, something not going the way you're hoping?
Absolutely. I mean, this business is a marathon, not a sprint.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common adage, and so many people have said it, but man, it is so true. And I remember starting out with really promising comedians, like really funny, like great joke writers, like people who I thought, man, that guy's like a great joke writer. I'll never be that good of a joke writer. And they dropped out of the business, you know, and I'm still here. Like, I'm still standing just by the way of me sticking to it, you know, and I've had my ups and downs in my career. And I've had, like, I've bombed so many times, but like, the longer you're in the business, you realize, like, Chris Rock bombs to this day.
Right.
David, you know, Jerry Seinfeld bombs, like Chappelle bombs, obviously Chappelle bombs. Like, all the greats have rough, Jim Gaffigan, like, I've seen him have rough nights.
Yeah.
So like every comedian, as genius as they are, they just have an off night. And it's not, it's sometimes it's just got nothing to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
It's just, in this business, it's just a marathon, not a sprint. And you just got to stick with it.
Yeah,
that's why I'm still here.
Yeah, that's great. I agree. I think that, you know, you see a lot of talented people in every area of life that just don't have the stamina, right? And people just, they give up too easily. Things 100%. Get hard.
I've followed Jerry Seinfeld on stage. Like, he, you know, I started stand up in New York City, and I was a comic in New York for like 8 years before I moved to LA. So I know a lot of I've worked with a lot of, you know, the big New York comics. And I've had to follow Jerry Seinfeld at Gotham Comedy Club, where he would just drop in unannounced. And then, you know, and so he dropped in one night, and I'm supposed to go up next. And they're like, Helen, you're getting bumped. And I'm like, I'm supposed to follow him? Like, what the fuck? Like, no, I can't do it. But the interesting thing about, like, I've been on stage with Jerry Seinfeld a couple times, but what's interesting about Jerry Seinfeld is he will get a standing ovation going up.
Yeah.
Like, they announce him, and obviously people are freaking out. They're like, oh my God, it's Jerry Seinfeld at this random club on a Thursday night? What the fuck? So he gets a standing ovation going onto the stage, but he doesn't always get one coming off.
Mm.
And that's because he's trying new material.
Sure.
And it's not his bangers. It's not his A game. You know, it's not, it's like, the reason why he's at that little club on a Thursday night is because he's trying new material for his next arena tour. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Like, it's not bangers, it's new stuff. A lot of it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so people are like, oh, okay, well, it was cool to see Jerry Seinfeld. That wasn't all that, but...
And that I mean, it's interesting.
That's such a lesson for me, and for it should be a lesson for everybody. It's like, you know, you can coast as long as you can coast on your reputation, but at the end of the day, it's about the jokes that, you know, right then. It's about that performance.
Well, I think you're right. But I also think, you know, and I've been to see Jerry on his two last tours, and which were a few years apart, and playing big theaters,
yeah,
ticketed shows, and it's this, and he did the same set, like almost word for word, like really? 3 years apart.
Yeah, really?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's disappointing. And,
well, you know, so here's, yeah, in a sense it is. It's 3 years, so you don't remember all the jokes. There's some of them that you realize throughout the show that, like, oh, I've heard this before.
Wow.
But
interesting.
But I also think, you know, a couple, like, one, when you're Jerry Seinfeld, you get to do things that not everyone else gets to do.
100%.
Right? Because when you go, and I've gone to, you know, I went and we saw Louis C.K. Do new material. It's Comedy Store, yeah. Right? And, you know, okay, some of the jokes were better than others. I've seen George Carlin, you know, do the same things.
Oh, wow.
But what you remember is, I spent this night watching George Carlin.
Exactly.
Or Louis C.K. or Jerry Seinfeld or whatever. Exactly. And you don't remember, was every joke the funniest thing I've ever heard?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And yeah. So I think there's some of that. And comedy is this unique thing where you get to work out, and you have to work out new material in front of an audience, right? And you don't, you know, George Clooney's not gonna do that, go rehearse some lines in front of a paying crowd, and neither is Metallica, right? Like, you know, most art has to be finished
exactly
when it's presented to the world. Exactly. And comedy, for whatever reason, we're okay as an audience participating in that process with the convenience.
And there's no way to do it. There's no other way to do it. Like, you can rehearse, you can practice your joke as long as you want in front of the mirror.
Right.
But you are not going to know if that joke works. You have no idea if that joke works until you get it in front of a crowd.
So how does that work with the new special with Wo Hung, right? It's I lost count, but it's a long set.
It's an hour.
An hour, which is a lot of material.
Yeah, and that so Wo Hung, my special, is the one unique. That's the one unique thing about this period of time where you couldn't necessarily get in front of a crowd. You know,
I
a lot of the jokes, the pandemic jokes, and the jokes about my new baby, they were brand new jokes.
Yeah.
Which you would never normally do that for a special. Like a comedian would never normally put brand new jokes in a special.
Yeah.
But because of the uniqueness of the time where I literally hadn't been in front of an audience for a year, this, you know, the taping happened at the Tribeca Festival, which was the first public event post lockdown in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was actually advertised as like New York's opening back up with the Tribeca Festival. Like that's how it was.
That's cool.
That's how it was advertised. And so literally, you know, I taped that special and like everybody in the room was freaked out. Like we were all like, oh shit, this is the first time we're like we've been in a enclosed space with other people for a year.
Sure.
So the whole everything about it was unique in that way. Where I had the only stand up I had been doing for that entire year was Zoom shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the only option for comedians during, you know, the pandemic, the peak pandemic year.
Yeah.
2020, where you could only do Zoom shows. Maybe there were a handful of outdoor shows that people were like, but even at the beginning, that was like risking your life.
Right.
You felt like you were risking your life to do an outdoor show. And the safest way was to just stay in your house and do a Zoom show.
Totally.
Which is totally not the same,
right?
You know, so
yeah, of course.
Half of this special is brand new material that had never been tested in front of a crowd, and that's kind of why I gave a little disclaimer at the beginning and at the end, you know, of the special. If you notice, I gave a little mm-hmm. disclaimer, like, this is either going to be a flaming shit show or a miracle. So thankfully it was kind of a miracle.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, it was, that's like, it was like a, that special to me is really like, like a bug caught in amber. It was like a time period that will never, hopefully never be recreated again, where it was like, we all went through this insane experience of being locked in our houses for a year. And yeah. we all had those similar experiences, like the jokes that I do about the mask and like wanting to hook up with doomsday preppers, you know, that is all stuff that I think is universal stuff that we all recognized from living through this crazy time of the pandemic.
Sure. Well, my wife's got a big stash of doomsday supplies in the garage, so
yeah.
I can relate. So what's the process of putting that show together, that much material? And like you said, without being able to go test it out, like,
yeah.
how do you, you know, do you envision the full hour and you sort of plan it from start to finish? Or do you just start writing jokes and then you stop when you're done?
No. I didn't write any. There were maybe 3 or 4 jokes that I wrote that I like finally like kind of finished writing for that special. But the rest of the stuff, like the pandemic material and the baby material, was stuff that I had been trying to work out over the Zoom shows, and it, definitely material that I had done before over Zoom. In as much as I could. And then there's the middle chunk, the Well Hong joke, which the special is named after, is about my dad. That's a joke that I've been doing for years. The dry wedding joke is a joke that I've been doing for a couple of years. So there's definitely like older material, like tried and true bangers, if you will, like the stuff that I know is going to work is kind of in the middle, which is unusual. Usually you put the stuff that works at the beginning, but I felt like I had to come out the gate with like addressing the elephant in the room, which is like, holy shit, we're out of our houses for the first time in a year. And like, isn't this crazy? And like masks and pandemic and like things that I've learned about myself. Like, I felt like I had to open with that stuff. Otherwise it wouldn't feel authentic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, they always say in comedian, in comedy, like you have to address the thing that people are thinking about. Like if there's a thing that's on everybody's minds, you have to address it out the gate. Otherwise people are distracted. You know, my comedy teacher, the very first teacher that I had at Caroline's 15 years ago said, she had if there's anything like specifically physically unusual about you, you have to get it out the gate at the beginning. Like she said, she had a student who had a club foot.
Oh, wow.
Who hobbled onto the stage and then never mentioned it.
Oh, you're kidding.
And like, she was like, nobody's hearing your jokes right now because they're wondering what's up with the club foot. You got to address the club foot out the gate. It's got to be the first thing that you say. You know, this is why like Josh Blue, you know, the first thing he says is about his cerebral palsy or, you know, anything that's like distinctly weird about you, you've got to address it out the gate. Otherwise they're distracted. Like that's all they're thinking about. Like what's with the club foot, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I guess I saw Chris Rock is playing here this weekend here in LA.
He's got to talk about the slap.
And of course, right? Can you imagine?
Like the slap has to be the first thing he talks about. Otherwise, the whole room is like, what's up with the slap?
You know? Of course.
Are you going to talk about the slap? Come on. Yeah, it's got to be the thing you address. And so that is just, it's a basic fundamental truth about stand-up. And so I had to open with pandemic material. I just
So you know, you talked about kind of starting out and you'd go and be you know, risque or disgusting, as you say, right? And I would say, you know, this special, not so much of that.
You know,
much more serious topics, and you talk about racial violence and so how deliberate are you about kind of your voice, right? Like, how do you, you know, to what extent do you just let it flow and you talk about something that might be, you know, off brand, or you're like, you know, I need 60% dirty jokes? And
no, I'm not that exacting.
I mean, I figured.
I'm not that. Some comedians are like,
yeah.
Jim Gaffigan is like, I mean, he's like with a measuring cup with
his jokes. Right?
Yeah. He's so specific. Any comedian who's like a wordsmith,
sure,
you know, and probably Seinfeld is a little bit like this.
Which I would imagine. Yeah,
which is why you know, he does the same jokes like 3 years apart, because he's just like, he's like, it's got to be a certain way, right?
Yeah.
And I know Gaffigan is like that. It's just, it's got to be a certain way, and like the wording has to be exact. Mm-hmm. And you know, everything's got to be exact. And I am not that I am just a let shit fly and hope for the best.
Sure.
You know, throw the spaghetti against the wall. Like, for instance, something that's happened to me since that special was taped is I had breast cancer.
Right.
And I had a double mastectomy, and I got fake boobs. And of course, I have to talk about that on stage. And that's a very serious topic. And the second you say cancer on stage, like the whole room, like you can just hear sphincters. All the sphincters are tightening. So I bring up cancer, and I'm like, I'm going to make it hilarious. Relax. Don't worry. Like, I'm going to tell you my cancer story. It's going to be fucking hilarious. You're going to love it. Yeah. And you know, and then that kind of loosens things up. But that's just I have to talk about it, because I want to make it a PSA. Mm-hmm. Tell people, like, I had cancer. It could happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. But also, it's what's happening in my life. It's the huge thing that's happening in my life. And that's what my stand-up is always about. It's about, like, you know, what's going on in my life. I'm not a wordsmith comedian. I'm not a clever puns comedian. Like, I have to talk about what's going on in my world and make it funny, you know, for me and for you. Like, it's almost like my form of therapy. Like, I had breast cancer. How can I make this hilarious? Like, what's the silver lining of this? For myself, and then I share it with you, you know. So I'm not that exacting. I'm not that that meticulous or planning. Like, I just let shit fly, and so I let the shit fly about the pandemic. I let the shit fly about the new baby that I have, which is my baby / not my baby. Mm-hmm. Like, how did I end up with a baby? And also now about my breast cancer. So. It's really good, because I feel like people at the end of seeing me for an hour really get to know me. They really get to know me. Whereas like some comedians, and I'm not knocking these comedians, they're excellent, you know, they're excellent people who do their craft. They're excellent at their craft.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily know who they are at the end of the hour, you know? Whereas me, like, I'm just talking about the shit that's actually going on in my life, and you really get a sense of who I am. And I feel like my audience is, after an hour, they really know me.
Yeah.
And they know what's going on with me. They know I have a baby at home, and you know, so they go on my Instagram, they see the baby, they see the dog, they see my, you know, me with the breast cancer, like the mastectomy bra and whatever, like, they really get to know me, so.
Yeah, and I feel like there's an expectation. Like you said, some comics, you know, are different. Some are, you know, we went and saw Nigel Lang, you know, recently, and he actually did something I've never seen before. He did two sets. He did one in character as Uncle Roger, and then came back out as himself and headlined for himself.
Yeah.
And it was really cool. What was I gonna say? I think some, like you said, their lane is I have a character or a storyline that I'm sticking to, right?
Yeah.
But then I think, you know, for the rest, I think there's become this expectation that you're going to kind of bare your soul, and you're going to, you know, we're relying on Chappelle to talk us through, you know, heavy social issues.
Absolutely.
And you know, and other people like him, right? That to bring up the things that are maybe taboo or people are afraid to talk about or express whatever.
And I love both of those types of comedy. Like, one of my favorite comedians is Maria Bamford, you know, and she's very character heavy.
Right.
But at the same time,
but also really vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. When you meet her, you're like, oh no, that is her. She's not putting it on. Like, she is really this quirky person. But I also love, Louis C.K., you know, and I love that confessional, like, ugh, I'm a trash bag human and
sure.
tell you all the reasons why.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I love Roy Wood Jr. He's one of my favorite comics.
Oh, I don't know.
He's, oh, you've got to look up Roy Wood Jr.
Okay.
He's a correspondent on The Daily Show.
Oh, okay.
He has one of my favorite specials of recent years.
Nice.
And he's really excellent. And he talks a lot about racial justice stuff. He's a black comic, talks a lot about Black Lives Matter and, like, you know, racial justice stuff and just so funny.
Nice.
So funny. Yeah. So you got to look him up. He's fantastic.
Cool.
One of my favorites.
Okay. Let's go back to the marathon. So I've seen you in a ton of things. My son was a huge Thundermans fan.
Oh, wow. And so
he grew up watching you and Silicon Valley and Inside Llewyn Davis and, you know, a lot of great things.
Thank you.
Is one of those, you know, did one of those stand out that, like, it really got the phones ringing and made a big difference in your career? Or is it more of the marathon? Is it each step?
Yeah,
one step at
for
a time?
Me, it's all the marathon still. Like that, no, there hasn't been one thing that's the phones are run out. I wish the phones were ringing more.
Of course.
But it's, I mean, I can't complain. I really can't. I mean,
sure.
I've had this really solid career and something that I feel like I moved from New York to LA. I started stand up in New York. Mm-hmm. And I kind of rose up the ranks of comedy in New York, and I was doing really well as a stand-up comic in New York. You know, the thing about New York is you can make a living just doing stand-up.
Is that right?
Yeah, 100%.
And is that different to LA?
100% different. You cannot
really
make a living just doing stand-up in LA. There's fewer clubs in LA. Mm-hmm. They're spaced far apart. You know, in New
sure.
York City, you've got
right.
13 full-time comedy clubs in like a
right.
5-square-mile area.
Right.
So you, on a Friday night, you can do 6, 7, 8 shows.
Got it.
In the same night, you know,
yeah.
you go one club, boom, you get off stage, you jump on the subway, you go to the next club, boom, you make your, you know, $75.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, you go to the next club. You can, you know, in one mm-hmm. night, you can make hundreds of dollars just running
right.
from club to club to club. And it's physically impossible in LA just because
sure.
of how everything is spaced out.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
You can't, like, find parking, jump in your car, go
I mean, you'll spend more on parking than,
yeah, exactly.
Than you make on stage.
That's exactly right. Drive 30 yeah. minutes to get to the next club. Like, you've already lost 30 minutes. Like, in New York, you can get to a club, like, in literally 15.
Sure.
So I was doing really well in New York, and New York was turning me into a raging cunt. I'm just going to say it.
Okay.
You can bleep it if you want. I was turning into the biggest bitch. New York is such a hard place to live, and it was hardening me.
Yeah.
Like, I was fantasizing about pushing tourists into the subway tracks. I was like annoyed all the time. Get the fuck out of my way. Why are you walking so slow?
Yeah.
You know, it's like every New Yorker's complaint about tourists in New York. Like,
sure.
fucking walk faster and walk in single file. Like, don't, like, four of you don't have to take up the entire fucking sidewalk so nobody can get around you.
Mm-hmm.
So every complaint about tourists in New York. And, you know, and I am an introverted person, like, which is weird to be a stand-up comic, but I think a lot of comics.
I think that's pretty common, actually.
Yeah, a lot of comics are introverts. And so I need a lot of alone time. And
mm-hmm.
the fact that I had to start my day in New York if I had a meeting or an audition.
Yeah, it's
like,
not.
The fact that I had to
not
start
a town for introverts.
In the subway, like, with 1,000 other people, like, it just was grating on my soul. And so I was noticing myself just being angry and annoyed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I can't live like this. Like, I'm done. I'm moving to LA. And I remember people in New York being like, whoa, Helen, you're really doing well in New York. Like, I had just been passed at the Comedy Cellar, which is like the holy grail of mm-hmm. comedy clubs in New York. And they're like, okay, you were just passed at the Comedy Cellar. You're going to let go of all that to move to LA where you have no job, no agent, no manager, the clubs don't know you, you're gonna start over. And I'm like, yep.
Mm.
I was like, I would rather do that than be here and like go to jail for pushing a tourist into the subway tracks because I finally snapped one day. So yeah, I took a leap of faith to move to LA, and I feel like that leap of faith was really rewarded because I did have to start over. I did move to New York with no job, no agent, and no gig, no manager. And it was like starting over. The clubs didn't know me. I kind of had to re-audition to get past all the clubs in LA. People didn't really know me. People knew me, you know, some of the bigger comedians who go back and forth knew me. And so I had a little bit of a leg up, like they watched me here and there. But I did spend a year kind of like starting over, not making any money, you know, kind of hustling and trying to get into the clubs. But that year went really fast. And because I was good, I did get passed at all the clubs. And I got an agent, I got a manager, like things happened really fast. And that's when I started, you know, I got Lumen Davis, I got the Thundermans was actually the first gig that I got in Hollywood.
Nice.
And I started booking TV shows and commercials and movies. And I feel like that all came because of the risk that I took. You know, the
Were there moments in that time when you questioned that decision?
No. I mean, there were definitely moments where I was like, oh my God, I can't pay my rent. Like, I'm going to have to move. I did move like a couple of years in. I had to move to like a much smaller apartment. I was like, oh, I can't live the way that I want to live in LA because I'm just not making enough money. Right. So that was obviously very stressful and concerning. But I always knew, I knew that I did the right thing. And then I would go to the beach and be like, ah, this is great. This is so much better than Coney Island.
Absolutely.
Being on Venice Beach or Santa Monica Beach is so much better than like trying to get to Coney Island with 5 million other people.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. And it's funny, every time I go to New York, I'm always wondering what I did to piss everybody off.
It's your existence as a tourist.
Exactly. Yeah. And so
also,
talk about
also walk faster.
Right.
Also exactly. Fucking walk faster.
Yeah, everybody's just upset for something.
Yeah.
Talk about the you have a YouTube show with your dad?
Yeah. Yeah. It's called Old Korean Dad Stories and Sometimes Mom.
Yeah.
Only because my mom is really shy and she doesn't like being on camera. That's the only reason why it's mostly dad.
That's funny.
But that came out of the pandemic because I'll tell you exactly how that came about. So it was the end of 2020, the first year of the pandemic. And you remember at the end of 2020, everyone was like, oh, worst year ever. Mm-hmm. Worst year ever.
Sure, of course.
Oh, God. Thank God this year is over. Worst year ever. Worst year ever. It was on the
like cover. On January 1st, everything's going to just
exactly,
start over.
Magically. Yeah. And of course it didn't. But,
no, it didn't.
But like, it was like the cover of Time Magazine said, you know, 2020, worst year ever.
Right.
And so my dad brought it up. My dad was like, oh, did you see the cover of Time Magazine? And I was like, no. And he's like, it says 2020 is the worst year ever. And I'm like, well, what do you think about that? And he goes, my dad's like, you know, pushing 80 at this point. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, yeah, I guess 2020 was pretty bad, but maybe the year that I was fleeing from the Korean War and starving and, you know, we were like, we were the war refugees and my baby brother died. Yeah, that might be the worst year for me. And I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know that he had a baby brother that died. Like, I didn't know. I had a whole ass uncle that I never heard about that died during the Korean War. And I just was like, whoa. And it just put everything in perspective for me.
Sure.
Where here we are, like, bitching in our houses that we don't have toilet paper, that 2020 is the worst year ever. And it was. Legitimately, 2020 was the worst year ever for a lot of people. Legit. You know, people lost housing. People lost their jobs. They couldn't afford food. Like, I get that. But, like, tell that to, like, anybody in Afghanistan. Or tell that to anybody in Iraq. Or anybody who's in Somalia, anyone in a war-torn country right now that's been happening for years, like, tell that to them, that 2020 was the worst year ever. Like, they'd be like, get the fuck out of here, you know? So it really put things in perspective for me. And it also made me realize, like, oh, shit, like, my dad has all these crazy stories that I've never asked him about, that I don't know about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hadn't seen my dad in a year because he lives across the country. We weren't allowed to visit. And so we were just FaceTiming a lot. And I was like, shit, I'm gonna like record these things, you know, and turn them into videos because this is so powerful. And
that's so cool.
I did that video about him talking about like his baby brother that died. I did that video and I submitted it to Now This, the media company. Now This, it's a big they post on Facebook and a lot of social media platforms, and they posted it and it did really well. And I was like, I'm gonna just do this as a regular thing and like put it on YouTube. And so I didn't do it as like a way to make money on YouTube. Like I just did it as a way to like have these stories in perpetuity. Sure. You know, you put them on YouTube and they're there forever.
That's right.
And so I, you know, I just started doing videos with my dad, like, and sometimes my mom, where I would like, I'm like, okay, I heard that copper can fight the virus. So I sent you copper mugs, and they're like unboxing copper mugs. And they're like, what is this? And I'm like, ah,
that's hilarious.
You know? So, so it's cool. I actually paused doing it. Unfortunately, like it's a lot of work.
Sure.
Like once things started opening back up and I started auditioning again and getting actual work, I had to stop doing the.
Yeah, of course. Work. It's a lot.
I'm really glad that those videos exist.
Yeah.
You know, where I talk to my parents about like crazy stories from their past.
So what, you know, you talk a lot about the pandemic and obviously you changed, you know, you had to change how you were doing things. What do you think you learned from the experience of living through the pandemic that you'll then use going forward in your work and your career?
Definitely, I need to fuck more doomsday preppers.
Stock up on some TP.
The doomsday preppers have the TP.
Okay.
And rice and beans and whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Nice.
What have I learned? I, you know, I think you just got to roll with the punches. I think that's the biggest thing that I learned.
Do you think you come out of it more easygoing? Is that?
No.
No, that's not your thing.
No, I'm not easygoing. I definitely need like a lot of, I need edibles to fall asleep every night. I need like industrial strength edibles to fall asleep every night. And that's only because I can't get enough Xanax from my doctor. As you know from my special, getting Xanax is like an odyssey.
That's so crazy.
It's an odyssey. But I think, for me, I kind of had to roll with the punches because the pandemic, for some reason, was just such a huge amount of change time for me. Like, I bought a house for the first time. I'm now a homeowner. I have a baby now, which is not my baby, but I'm raising a baby. If you want to figure out, if you want to find out how, watch my special. You'll find out why I'm raising a baby that's not my baby.
That's right.
I got breast cancer in the last year during the pandemic. I mean, this is all shit that I, like, if you told me that I would have new fake boobies in a new house that I own with a dog, that I, first time I've ever adopted a dog, and I'm also raising a baby. If you told me this 2 years ago, I'd be like, get the fuck out of here. Like, who the fuck do you think I am?
Sure.
I'm like cooking baby food at like 2 o'clock in the morning so the baby has something to eat tomorrow. Nice. Like, this is like, who the fuck am I? I'm the least Martha Stewart bitch.
Is that right?
Yes.
So you say. But then you're cooking baby food at 2 in the morning.
I mean, who the fuck am I? Every time I cook something for the baby, I'm like, who the fuck am I? Like, I barely know how to boil eggs. Like, and I'm now following YouTube recipes on how to make toddler food. Like, who
That's
the fuck
hilarious.
Am I? But this is all stuff that you got to roll with the punches. You have to roll with the punches. That's what life is about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So your Go Fact Yourself podcast, right? So you interview people about their...
Yeah.
Areas of expertise.
Super fun. I love it so much. It's like when you ask people about shit that they're really excited about and their whole face lights up, and it can be anything from like depression glass. Like, I didn't know what depression glass was.
Never heard of that.
But man, it's somebody's thing. It lights them up, you know?
So what's your thing? If you were a guest on the show, what topic would you be interviewed about?
I know a lot about huskies. Because my dog,
the dogs.
Yeah, husky dogs. Because my dog is a husky mix, and he's the first dog I've ever had. And so when I got him, I like deep dove into huskies.
Okay.
And so I know a lot about huskies, and they're very interesting to me. And I know a lot about the Donner Party because I really am into people eating people.
Okay.
I know a lot about the Donner Party and also the story about, like, that movie Alive was based on, about the rugby team that was stranded on top of the mountain.
That movie was scary.
I'm obsessed with people eating people for some reason. I've never eaten anyone myself, but I
That you know of?
That I know of. Yeah, that I know of. I've never eaten anybody. But, like, I always wonder if I'm in that situation. Because I don't even eat red meat anymore. So I'm like, I don't eat red meat. And could I go from not eating red meat for, like, psychological reasons? Like, I can't get past, like, cute baby cows. Mm-hmm. Could I eat a human if I was starving? I mean, probably I could.
I think you would.
Yeah, probably I could.
I get a sense you would, instinct would take over. You just fuck somebody up with a knife and fork.
Yeah, but, like, I just find that shit really fascinating. And so I read a lot. And I don't read a lot, but I watch a lot of, like, documentaries and listen to a lot about the Donner Party and the rugby.
That is, those are very specific interests.
Yes.
I like it.
And also, what else do I, that, oh, Star Trek The Next Generation, obvi.
Okay.
Fucking love.
Is that right?
I have the hots for older bald men because of Sir Pat Stew.
Okay.
Patrick Stewart, because I was so obsessed with Star Trek The Next Generation when I was a kid.
Nice. Yeah. I got to spend a little time on set.
What?
Yeah, my aunt was a script supervisor on Deep Space Nine.
No fucking way.
And her partner was a cameraman on Next Generation.
No.
So I used to go up to Paramount, and I'd visit both sets and hung out with LeVar Burton and some other folks.
My dick is out. Because of you telling me this. Like, this is the most turned on I've ever been.
Really?
No. But I'm excited.
I would hope not.
Yeah. but I'm so jealous that you had that
Yeah,
experience.
It was cool. It was cool. And I would say, you know, for, you know, now that you have a kid and having kids around, like, bring them to sets. Because being, I grew up, you know, my aunt would always invite me up to sets. I've been on 20, 30 sets as a kid. And it's super fun. And
yeah.
It's a huge memory for me. And, you know, meeting the $6 Million Man and John Stamos and, all these people when you're, like, 12 years old.
That's awesome. Really,
it's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I wished I had that experience, especially because now of what I do now. But, yeah, when we were doing Thundermans, so the Thundermans was sometimes taped in front of a live audience. Mm-hmm. So the audience would be, like, mostly kids, obviously, and they just were so excited.
Oh, yeah.
So excited.
Yeah.
You know, and we would all spend time afterwards to, like, meet them and sign autographs if they wanted and take pictures. Not autographs. No, kids don't want autographs. They want pictures.
Photos. Of course. Yeah.
Photos with them, and it was super exciting for them, and, you know, so it was draining for us, but we would, like, spend the time to do it because they – were so stoked, and they're like, how can you say no to, like, a stoked 9-year-old?
Of course. Yeah. I hope not. Not if you have a heart.
Yeah.
So you do so many things. You're a very busy woman.
Yeah.
How do you decide what to say no to?
That's a really good question. How do I decide what to say no to? I just go by instinct, you know, like, I feel like I'm at the point in my career where, like, if I'm being asked to audition for, like, a one-liner, I'm like, no. You know what I mean?
Or sure.
Like, there's enough video of me out there that you can find that you know that I can do it or not.
Totally.
But I generally have a rule to say yes to most things. Yeah, I used to have a rule to say yes to everything.
Okay.
And that was a mistake. Or that wasn't a mistake for the time. That was a good learning lesson that if you say yes to everything, you will get burnt out really fast. So for a couple of years, like when I first moved to LA, like when my career started heating up, like a few years into being in LA, and I would say yes to everything, and that was draining.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody's short film or everybody's like shitty show, you know, shitty barroom show that's maybe gonna have four people in the audience,
right?
You know, or like or like the Comedy Store, the last spot at the Comedy Store closing out the night at 1:45 a.m. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say yes to all that. And now I don't say yes to those things because it was just draining. Like, there's only so much you can do as a human being.
And so was that a conscious choice that you're like, I have to change the way I'm doing things?
Yeah. Because yeah. I thought that saying yes to everything was like a good way to be as a human. Like, yeah. I say yes to everything. The universe brings me these opportunities. There's a reason why, you know, the universe has presented this opportunity to me. And so I'm just going to say yes and accept it. But I was tired all the time and I was drained all the time. And I was like, oh God, I shouldn't have done that 2 o'clock in the morning show in front of drunk people at the Comedy Store. Like, that didn't bring me anything. It didn't do anything for me. And all it did was made me tired and cranky the next day. Yeah. So that was a learning opportunity for me. That was a learning experience for me to be like, okay, I have to be like, say yes to most things, but not say yes to everything.
Yeah. And I feel like the more successful people get, the more they have to excel at saying no to things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But also know what, you know, say yes to the things that seem like they should say yes to. Like, I'm very intuitive, like, oh, that seems like really cool. Or like, I just said yes to moderating the Star Trek convention.
I mean,
because like,
but you love Star Trek. So
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like, the money wasn't great.
Right. Sure.
The money wasn't great.
Yeah. But you probably, like, you would have done, I hate to tell them, you would have done it for less.
Don't tell them, but I 100% would have.
Yeah.
I 100% would have. Now that I've done one,
right,
I won't.
Now you want to get paid for the second.
Now I want to get paid.
Like, yeah, of course.
Now that I know how much work it is and how like draining it is, like, it's a lot of work. They had me moderating a bunch of panels back to back. And so it was really draining and really exhausting. And, you know, they expect you to know, like, be up to speed, like, what to ask George Takei and what to ask the cast of Strange New Worlds. Like, so now that I've done one, I will definitely ask for more money. But they asked me very little money to do a Star Trek convention. And I was like, yes!
Sure.
I'll be there. I'm so excited.
Of course. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, let me do a quick lightning round before I let you get on with your life. What's your favorite city to travel to?
Favorite city? Seattle, Washington.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I love that Pike Market for some reason. I go every time. Like, I just love the guys throwing the fish, and I love that it's on the wall. Something I really like about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Who's your favorite DJ? And if you don't have one, your favorite band you've ever seen live?
The Cure. I love The Cure.
Great show.
I still love Depeche Mode too.
Yeah.
I mean, both of those bands put on a great frickin' show. There were bands that I loved as a child, and for nostalgic reasons, I still see them. They still tour. Like, they're in their 60s.
Yeah, of course.
They're in their 60s now, I think, and they're still touring, and every time I see them going on tour, I will still go, and they're still crushing it. Like, it's crazy. These, like, 60-year-old men are still, like, they're
so
still,
good.
Like, giving a good show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good. I never saw The Cure on tour, but I saw them at Coachella. That was amazing.
They're awesome.
Killer show.
Yeah.
Really, what's good. The last great book you read?
Oh God, I don't read. You know, from my special, I don't read. The last great book I read, Green Eggs and Ham or something that I read. Pound Pound Fish, which is like a book that the kid is obsessed with.
It's funny how, you know, when you have, I have a 12-year-old and you end up reading some books over and over and over.
He loves Pow Pow Fish so much. And Pow Pow Fish is like, I'm a pow pow fish with a pow pow face, and I spread the dreary wearies all over the place. That's literally the best book that I've read. It's literally one of the only books that I've read.
Okay. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
Oh, that's a really good question. What movie have I seen the most in my life? Weirdly enough, I think it's Terminator 2.
Okay.
Terminator 2.
I think that was the best of this. I mean, I haven't watched all of them, but I think it was better than the first one.
I am split. Okay. No, you're right. You're right. It's better than the first one. It's better than all of them. It's like a genuinely legit, probably one of the best movies ever made. And I know people are going to like scream when they hear that, but like, it's legit.
We have a very discerning audience.
It's a legit. Yeah,
when it comes to movies.
Fucking great movie. I mean, the technical shit for the time is amazing. The casting, like the Terminator, the guy that turns into like liquid.
Mm-hmm.
He's like that guy. Like, what a perfect cast.
Oh yeah, for sure. I remember
nobody
I saw
else
him.
Else could have done it.
I remember seeing him in something else afterwards, and I'm like, this asshole. Like, you wrong. Just couldn't not hate him.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. For sure. He was just so good, and like yeah. Arnold was great, and Eddie Furlong, the kid. Mm-hmm. Perfect yeah. casting, and then oh my god, what's the actress's name?
Yeah, it was, I forgot her name.
Exactly, the woman who played Sarah Connor, iconic. Mm-hmm. The fact that mm-hmm. remember her, like everyone was like, she's her body is the best
totally
like, special effect from that movie. I mean, she was jacked.
Yeah,
in that
sure.
movie, and she kicked ass. And I just love a strong feminist. That's what I'll give up. I'll give up for James Cameron. Sometimes he can be real cheesy, but like he loves a strong female
sure.
like character, like a kick-ass badass yeah. bitch, and I love that.
See, I love that answer because a lot of people's the movie that, you know, is like some shitty comedy that's just on like Comedy Central 12 times a year and you watch yeah. it when you're flipping through, you know.
No, I mean, that's the other beauty about T2 is like they play it a lot, you know, every yeah. time they play it, I'll watch
yeah,
it. But
sure.
also like I will actively watch it. Like I own, you
that's
know,
great.
A copy of it and I'll actively seek out and watch it. It's just a classic. It's just really fucking, it's entertaining and it's good.
Love it. Who's somebody that you've learned a lot from that you haven't met?
Joan Rivers.
Mm.
I wasn't stand-up comedy fan
sure.
as a young person. I had yeah. no idea who she was. I had heard her name. Honestly, I only knew her from like when she was like shitting on people's clothes for me. Remember?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that
yeah.
was like the last
yeah,
thing she
sure.
did. She was like red carpet and just shit on people's outfits. Yeah. So that's how I knew her. I just thought she was just like this old lady who just shit on people's clothes. But then I watched the documentary. There was a documentary mm-hmm. that came out
yeah,
called
yeah.
A Piece of Work.
Brilliant.
Dude, I was like, she is a goddamn beast as a comic. The mm-hmm. fact that there's a scene in the movie where like she shows her card catalog. She has like a library card catalog of every joke she's ever written and
no way.
Alphabetized.
That's
every
crazy.
Joke she's ever written, she put it on an index card and alphabetized that shit and has like thousands and thousands of cards in a card catalog and she can pull out and they're like by topic. Like
that's
alphabetized
amazing.
By topic.
Sure.
So she's got one on like abortion, kids, you know, dogs, mm-hmm. like every topic. And she's, and I was like, dude, that is fucking like, what a hardworking comedian. There's also scenes where she's like going over her calendar and she's like freaking out of her open dates. If she mm-hmm. ever had an open date where she wasn't working, she would freak out. And this is like when she was in her 70s.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, there's so much. There's also a great scene of her dealing with a heckler, which was really inspiring to me because someone was like, you can't joke about people with disabilities. And she was like, fuck you. My husband had one leg. Fuck you. And she just went after this guy.
Wow.
Whereas like a less seasoned comedian would have shriveled like,
sure.
my son's disabled and how fucking dare you talk about
yeah,
disabled
yeah, yeah.
people. And like, you know, like, especially now we live in such a PC world, like a touchy
sure.
PC world where other comedians would be like, I'm so sorry, I apologize. And she just went right. She was like, fuck you. My husband had one leg. Go fuck yourself. You're not the only one with pain. Fuck you. Like, and I was like.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great lesson, right? And I think when you're in that moment, when you're up on stage, you can't apologize. You have to own it and you got to you got to go.
Or if you know that you're wrong, you should apologize. You know, you,
okay, maybe.
There's
sure.
definitely
yeah.
times
I mean,
where,
yeah,
you,
sure.
where you say shit on, you know, it's not.
I guess, it's, I guess, I mean, is like, is it's about your conviction, right?
Exactly. If you know you're right,
yeah.
stand by it.
Yes.
If
exactly.
you know that you're wrong, own it.
Sure.
That's the thing. It's like sometimes I do say shit on stage where I'm like, oh, that was fucked up. I shouldn't have said that. And then, you know, and then I do owe someone an apology. But most yeah. of the time, if somebody's getting touchy about some joke, because it's like, they've laughed at everything else that I've made fun of, but this is their
right.
thing that they're
sure.
talking about. Yeah. Like Amber Alerts. I did a joke about Amber Alert. No, I did a joke about peanut allergies. And I've had so much blowback from parents who are like, my
is that
child,
right?
yes. My child has a life-threatening peanut allergy, and how dare you make fun of it? You know what? Go fucking suck on a peanut. Go suck on an almond, bitch. Like, you can't laugh. The rest of us can't laugh about peanut allergies because your kid has a peanut allergy. Like, fuck off.
That's crazy. I don't have a peanut allergy, so I'm not sensitive.
I won't tell you to suck on a peanut then. Suck on my almond dick.
But I have read about how China apparently has like no peanut allergies, and it's because they just feed peanuts to babies all the time,
and then they die.
No, they don't. No. Yeah, exactly.
And then the kids who have it die.
Exactly.
Nope. End of problem.
No, but the point being, the parents are making it worse by avoiding peanuts. Anyway, 100%. That's a topic that I know nothing about. Last question. If I worked for you, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Oh, for fuck's sake. It's my favorite phrase.
For I like
fuck's
it.
Sake. I don't know why. For some reason, it's more satisfying than fuck, just fuck, or
okay.
shit. For
yeah.
fuck's sake. It's so satisfying. I love it.
Well, there's a certain exasperation attached to it,
and,
right?
And it's,
that,
like
that
every,
it's like
every, and it's like
you're
clumsy.
Not, you're just being pained. It's a pained expression.
Yeah, and I'll say it like, you know, like I can't find the fucking, you know, like these fucking iPhones now. Like you can't use a regular headphone.
Oh right. right.
You need the yeah. dongle that attaches, uh-huh. and it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, Apple, really?
Well, just wait. I think they're changing it again on the next phone.
These assholes. These Apple assholes. Ugh.
Helen, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank
super
you for
fun
having
talking
me.
To you.
Thank you for really having me.
Really appreciate it. Everybody, go watch Will Hong. Where do we find it?
It's on Prime, it's on Apple TV Plus, and it's on YouTube.
Awesome. Thank and where should everybody follow you?
You can follow
where
me.
Do you like to post?
On Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Funny Helen Hong. Some other bitch named Helen Hong has my shit.
Fuck her.
Fuck her.
Love it. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yo, that was Helen Hong on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you check out her special, Well Hong, online. I think you're going to love it. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.